welcome to Mind Over Matter. I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder, and tonight we are live on the air, and our topic for discussion is one that many of us wish to avoid, but most of us will have to eventually experience, and that is the grieving process that follows the death of someone we love. And our other topic is death, and all of us will die. With me tonight is Claire Richardson, who is Vice President for the Foundation for End-of-Life Care in Juneau and is a longtime volunteer chaplain at Bartlett Hospital. She also serves on the hospital's Ethics Committee. Claire has a master's degree from Seattle University in Pastoral Studies, and she completed her internship in spiritual care at St. Christopher's Hospice in London, England. I lead and am currently leading an 8-week bereavement group at Hospice and Home Care of Juneau. So between us, I think we will have an informed discussion about death, dying, and especially about bereavement. And it will be much more interesting if you will call in with your questions and comments. And please feel free to call in on any topic that is in the realm of death and dying and bereavement, even if at the moment we aren't speaking of it. This is a one-hour show, so you have until 8 o'clock or several minutes before 8 to call in. You can contact us anytime during this show. Just call 463-6433 and we'll get you on the air. Or you can call, and if you wish to remain anonymous, our operator will write down your question or comment, which I will read over the air. So don't be shy. Give us a call with your questions or comments. Again, the number to call is 463-6433. Now, let me welcome Claire Richardson.
My golly, we better have a good show tonight because we're competing with the folk festival. So.
Yes. Definitely.
For those of you that are tuning in, that's wonderful, and it's a blustery, blustery day, completely different from yesterday, and, you know, I think the motto for this next hour was live as if you were to die tomorrow and learn as if you were to live forever, which is from Gandhi, and that is the first quote in the When You're Not Here, A Guide for Helping Those You Love, which we're going to talk about tonight.
Great, great. Well, why don't we start by, could you tell us about the End of Life Foundation?
It's the Foundation for End of Life Care here in Juneau, and it's an amazing organization, nonprofit. It was started quite a few years ago by some people in town in Juneau who really wanted to support education, support the Juneau Hospice, and be able to share information. And so the Foundation for End of Life Care are the folks that we brought you Lonnie Leary last fall. We bring speakers into town. We have workshops for professionals. And coming up in November is Hospice Month. And actually tonight, Elaine, when you're asking people to call in, boy, I'd love to get ideas from folks because we're planning on, we're going to decide whether we're going to do a series of workshops next fall for folks because our survey of people who came, we had like almost 200 people at the lecture that first night and then over 60 at the workshop the next day. People just said to us in their survey, we want more information. We know that it's hard to talk about this, but we want workshops. We want to learn about how do you prepare for death? How do you help someone who's dying? What do you do after somebody dies? And so we're prepared to do that, but people might have other suggestions for us. So what is that number again? People can call in.
Let me get it. It's 586. I'm sorry. Let me repeat that. 463-6433, and so you would like people to call in with suggestions of the kind of workshop that the Foundation for End of Life Care.
Foundation for End of Life Care could provide next fall. And what we're thinking of doing, like we did last time, is we had KTOO videotape it. We share it on 360 North. We share it online. We're trying to use different ways of reaching people because not everybody has a chance to sit down, come in, and watch something, but we want it on demand so that anytime you have a question, there's information you can just pick up just like that.
I have seen the book. What is it titled?
This is called When You're Not Here, and this is a guide for people. It was designed by Ginny Palmer, Hal Geiger. Lots of other people were involved, but they really spearheaded this amazing book. It's for sale at Hearthside. But somebody just said we should do a workshop on the book because
it
walks you through. It's place-based, so it tells you what's happening here in Alaska, who you would call. There's lots of good books about these topics, but, for example, people that are interested in finding out about what happens the first hour after somebody dies, the first day, the first week, the first month, the first year. It really walks you through so many different facets of that, from what to do with the body, how to deal with a funeral, what to do with finances. And let me tell you, it is shocking the number of people who don't have wills, don't have guardianships in place. They have minors, children who are under the age of 18. People just have such a hard time reconciling with this. So if you get this booklet, you can just go step by step and understand. They even help you explain the terminology, because really when you enter into palliative care, end-of-life care, and grief, you might hear lots of unfamiliar words. And so we can even walk you through the words that you're going to hear from caregivers, from doctors, from the mortuary, all those people that are talking to you. You want to be able to understand what it is they're saying.
Well, you know, it's natural to be in denial of our own mortality, and it's just a human condition. I think that there's always a fear of death, and there's an avoidance of dealing with things that have to do with death, no matter what age you are. And I know that I've seen the book, and I've handed it out to people in my bereavement group and at other places, and I bet a lot of unfinished books are sitting on the shelves. So I heartily support your idea that it would be Let's Fill Out the Book Together workshop, because I think you can get the book and then put it down. But it's very interesting how just the act of filling out the book, I think it's mentally healthy, because the more we're aware of the fact that we don't live forever and that we cannot predict the time or the way we're going to die, there's, I think, a belief that we're all going to die when we're 99.9 and that dying is for the aged. And, of course, statistically, that isn't exactly true. So,
well, especially in Alaska, and I think people who are listening tonight know that it seems lately, but we have so many young people dying. We have such a high suicide rate. We have high mortality rates, accident rates. People are grieving. And I really, it's so interesting to me. I was talking to a woman the other day whose adult daughter is going through a grieving process. And she inadvertently said to her daughter, "You need to get over this. You need to bust through this. You need to keep going." And I said, "You know, your daughter's where she is in her grief. If she's not ready to move on, she's not ready to move on." And the mom said, I know, it's just so hard for me to see her so sad, so unable to, quote unquote, move through it. And I think that one thing in Juneau and Alaska is we're dealing with lots of tragedy, lots of deaths. And so when, like Lonnie Leary spoke about aging and dying, that is a difficulty. We can talk about that tonight. But I think traumatic death in Alaska, we don't talk about just how much grieving is going on a continual basis, and not just for those of us in our 50s, 60s, and 70s grieving, people who are as old or older than us dying, but children, teens, and young adults are grieving the deaths of their aunties, their uncles, their siblings, their neighbors, their fellow students. It is an immense pain that you can feel. And I would like to say one thing I've noticed as a chaplain and also as a member of this community is the role of Facebook in changing the way people are grieving publicly. And I first started noticing it when John Coet died 2 years ago.
A local Juno, was a local Juno.
And
resident.
He died in Minnesota. And, of course, he had a Facebook page, like all of us, and we all started putting things on his page. And I think it's really interesting that when Mackenzie Howard was murdered in Cake in February, the Facebook has become a way for the community and for the whole state to be able to mourn together. And some people may not like that, but that's what's happening. And there are mementos and memorials and pictures and poems and videos and music. Mm-hmm. People, it's almost like a collaborative effort. So you may have a Facebook page, but then they have a memorial page. And oddly enough, Elaine, that's actually an issue for after you die. There's a new book that's just come out that a neighbor lent to me. It's called When Someone Dies, The Practical Guide to the Logistics of Death by Scott Taylor Smith. And very similar to the things that are covered in the Juno book that we have. But one thing he's talking about is your electronic footprint after you die.
Yeah.
What do you do?
Your email account, your Facebook page.
All that. And it turns out that apparently you can memorialize somebody's page and only their friends can see it. So the public couldn't access it. It would only be their friends that had been friended before they died. Mm-hmm. And so as we talk about grief, I think that media, the new types of media, the Twitter, the Facebook, the Instagram, that's the way I see young people and older people expressing their sorrow.
And sharing.
Sharing in a virtual community. So interesting changes. I don't know how everyone feels about it, but by golly, it's there. It's not going to change.
It's happening. And it's interesting because someone in an older age group like you and me, who are
you,
used
Elaine,
to,
not me. I'm
oh, that's
still
right.
Really super young.
She's a kid.
Yeah.
I can't include her in my age group.
Yeah.
But anyways, announcements on Facebook may seem to us as tacky. That's not how you would announce something as profound as somebody's death. On the other hand, if you grow up with Facebook, it may be the normal way to express everything.
Well, I think what's interesting for me is as new generations come along, the way that we express our grief, and here in Alaska, we are so many miles away from different people. We get weathered in. A lot of us can't make it to memorial services. Many people have their ashes spread in the water. There's no location for you to go to a grave site. I did get permission from Mackenzie Howard's mother to talk tonight about some of the aspects of grieving in the village of Cake when her daughter was murdered. And we can talk about that, not necessarily this very moment, but I do think what's interesting is that hundreds of people were able to express their concern around the state, people that they'd never even met were able to extend their love and concern via Facebook, and it was a very powerful tool. And actually, for the mother, it was something where she was able to express how grateful she was. She was able to reach out to people who wanted to reach out to her. And a lot of times when people die, we're afraid to say something to the survivors, especially if it's a suicide or a murder or something awful. It allowed people to express how they felt in a way that they weren't face to face, but they were able to be very heartfelt about it. And we find that sometimes people are inappropriate in expressing their reaction or what they say to grieving people. And so part of that is they can see how other people have said it, and then they can echo that. They can use that as a way that they would like to say. So people are actually modeling positive behavior in how to express grief. And I find that the pictures people were taking and editing pictures of Mackenzie with sunsets or with songs that they had created. And so it's a creative outlet for people to express their grief, but also you could choose to go there, but you don't have to look at it if you don't want to.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Anything more to say about the grieving process in Cake over Mackenzie's death?
Well, I was profoundly touched by the Tlingit traditions in Cake, and of course,
Claire, I'm going to interrupt because we should mention to our listeners your relationship to Cake and how you knew Mackenzie.
Well, through my professional work as a community engagement educator, Cake School District is one of the school districts I work with, and Mackenzie's mother was a community engagement advocate for the school district for the previous school year, so I had gotten to know Marla as well as Mackenzie. And so when this tragedy occurred, I was able to go down and spend some time down there for the memorial and the funeral and the burial and the potlatch that night and other things that happened. But I think what's amazing is for Cake, what I didn't understand was there was a memorial service here in Juneau where hundreds of people came. We fed about 450 people. I worked in the kitchen. I had no idea where all the food came from. It just materialized. And all the flowers and everything, it just was all there. And so I decided I would go down. And the tradition is that the family doesn't pay for anything. And everyone just donates money, time, meat, produce, all the things that would go into feeding hundreds and hundreds of people. Then people just showed up to work in the kitchen all day. They have a memorial service. And then what's interesting in Cake is the morning of the funeral, the men go out to Grave Island and dig the grave. And then food is made for those men that went out there to dig the grave. Then they come back. It's just a short boat ride away. And then after the funeral service, all the students carried the flowers, all the, and they process out of the community center in downtown Cape, and they walk through across the dock and down the ramp, and then they load up these, by then it was two fishing vessels, and the casket is placed there in the flowers, the family, the friends, and then the boat heads over to Grave Island. And as it did so, the ferry was coming, and the ferry slowed and stopped. And then you would hear the horns of the boats and like this happy circle that the boat did. And then it headed to Grave Island. And then I was not there. I stayed on the other side and took photos. Then they buried Mackenzie. And, of course, just 2 weeks before, they had buried Clarence Jackson Sr. there. And then they come back over. And then that night is the potlatch where the family thanks everyone who's helped them. And there's, I think we fed 550, 600 people. 40 days later is the 40-day luncheon, the party to remember the person who was deceased. And so there's ritual grieving. And I thought that by the use of Facebook, people from Cake who didn't live in Cake were able to be a part of it. And also people in Juneau who are very close to the family were able to be here at the memorial service.
And know about it.
Right.
You know, this brings up one of the impediments, I think, to grieving in, I would say, mainstream America, and that is the diminishment of grieving rituals in our society. You know, since the dawn of human culture, we've had elaborate, all cultures have had elaborate grieving rituals and practices. Until now, where our mainstream culture is mostly in denial about death, according to sociologists and others who really observe these changing cultural patterns. Sometimes there's no funeral or memorial service, and compare that with Mackenzie.
Mm-hmm.
And also what happened with Mackenzie, though it was a death that was in the newspapers and so tragic that many, many people knew about it, that is the kind of mourning ritual that will occur to any community member who's part of the Tlingit community. We're such a mobile society. We often live far from extended family or even have little sense of community in order to do this. And you can imagine that this ritual in Cake has gone on over and over and over again, which itself is comforting. They don't have to reinvent the wheel on this. And, you know, some of the stress when someone dies, it's up in the air for many people. What do? Do you have a memorial service? Do you have an immediate funeral? If you're an observant Jew, you have, I believe it's 7 days until you have the funeral. So it's not like, okay, should we wait till summer when all the relatives can come in? It's really stressful not to have a protocol.
Mm-hmm.
It's much easier to have just a Catholic mass or a traditional funeral. And, you know, another Jewish example is sitting Shiva, which is, you know, for 3 to 7 days, people, depending on the tradition, Jewish tradition you're in, you sit at home and you are visited and fed. People bring food by friends and family. I've lived in India and Nepal for 6 years, and I can tell you that the rituals around death are extremely elaborate, take time, take energy, and are community-based. And there's something like sitting Shiva. I remember when I lived in a village in Nepal, there were friends of ours where a family member had died. They were all white instead of black. White is their mourning color. And I believe it was about for a week where they stayed indoors. Nobody left. And just like sitting Shiva, everybody came, fed them, visited them. And here, it's quite possible that nothing would happen. That would be the extreme, literally nothing. And we need rituals to grieve. Grieving needs company. And we need rituals to grieve. So
yeah, and it's, I think that, you know, people are adapting. And especially now that many people are not affiliated with a religious denomination or a religion, that did give a structure to the grief, but it's still there. And that's one thing I'd like to work on with folks here in town is to be able to maybe just have a workshop, plan your own funeral. You know, what is it you would like to have happen? And some people are very specific, but it is a burden on people if somebody dies and they don't give you any instructions of what to do. People are, it's very stressful. They want to do the right thing, but they're not sure what mom or dad wanted or what their sister wanted. And if there's some conflict in that, it can be very painful. But for some people who are very specific, by golly, it makes it a lot easier.
And the book that the Foundation for End of Life Care provides, since I've gone through it, I believe it has places where you tell what you want, the disposal of your body, if you want to be cremated or buried. No?
It has all that. And I think the thing is, I think when I interned in England, I was really shocked. I mean, my parents are British, but I had no idea how matter-of-fact the British are about death. You know, it's just done, you know. It's just, it's all happening. We all get cremated. You know, it's all very, everyone's very upfront about it. There's very little space in England. It's a tiny island with millions of people. And so 78% of the people that die are cremated.
Mm-hmm.
It is 98% of people who have cancer in England receive some form of palliative care, which means palliative means the, you know, this end of life care. It's
not to try to save their life; it's to make their life more comfortable.
Right, and to also, you know, explore those options. And they are very matter of fact about it, and it's not really hush hush. And maybe it's because so many people live in the cities, and you know, sometimes in the lower 48, you know, the only place you see old people are at Sun City or in these retirement centers, but they're very much integrated into the cities. They're everywhere.
Yeah.
And I see that here in Juneau. I mean, I think that our I was at that concert last night, the other day, the Ninth Symphony, and, you know, all ages together watching, participating. And I think that that's one plus we have in our community is we are integrated that way.
In Great Britain, do they have continuous care communities like we have in the States where old people pretty much, you know, everything from Sun City, where it's for active seniors, as they say, where you have your own home or your own condo, to nursing homes or, well, actually communities where you could have your own apartment, but then it's continuous care. So essentially you're ghettoizing the elderly. Do they have that situation in
England? I can just say for my relatives, they're all aging in place. In their old homes in towns across the country, and they have national health, and they have caregivers that come in if they need, you know, they need to strategize for making bathroom doors bigger or, you know, bringing the bed downstairs. But people are mostly aging in place of my relatives, which crosses the economic spectrum from those that are on the dole to those who are, you know, able to take care of themselves.
I think one of the big topics for people between, let's say, mid-60s on up is what kind of gamble you're going to take, because we don't have universal health care like you do in every other developed country in this on this planet. Since we don't, we're anxious about what will happen. So I think what happens is that some people will preempt any sudden illness or disability and earlier than they need to move into a continuous care facility, which means you go from, my in-laws were living in one in Chicago. They had their own apartment, but they bought into a meal plan. It's just like college dormitories. But sometimes in that place, they even had little, I'd say bungalows, separate houses where you didn't have a meal plan. And it went all the way down to memory care, as it's called, for dementia, and nursing care. So basically, you were there till you died. And so one of the reasons people will go in there before they have to is that they can buy in while they're still allowed in.
Mm-hmm.
And so you wouldn't have to do that in England. And what a cost saving and what a misery saving. In other words, people don't like to move.
Well, and I know people want to talk about grief and bereavement, but just in those aging, going to these different places, most people can't afford those homes with our assisted living that go on to whatever, unless you have a really good insurance policy or a lot of money that, or you have a home you can sell.
You have to buy in. It's for middle, upper, middle class and beyond.
Right. So for many of us, that's not an option. And so I think that that's people are discussing here in Juneau. What do you do with an aging population where there's Wildflower Court, there's the Pioneers Home.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's
pretty limited.
Yeah. But I think for grief, I think the other thing, too, for here is that for many of us, our families are outside. And so when they our parents die, we come back to Juneau and we have to grieve away from the family. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's an issue that concerns me. One nice thing, I'm jealous of some of my friends who grew up here. Their families are here.
Yes.
So when something bad happens, you know, the whole family can rally around. And I think about the Thibodeaux, when Bob Thibodeaux died and the family was able to rally around. But I'll never forget looking at that funeral mass, and there were all 12 of his children by age, and then all their spouses and children all behind them. And I thought, wow, this is amazing. It was really like the history of Douglas and Juneau right there in one funeral. But it was so awesome to see a large family like that be able to come together and just really send their dad off in a really wonderful way.
Well, it's the super mobility in our country, which, by the way, is far greater than in other developed countries, and I'm sure far greater than third world countries. I would guess that we have the most mobile population in the world, which really impacts the experience of dying and the experience of grieving, because many of us, my family's in Chicago, as my parents were as my husband's parents were dying, and well, let's just say they were aging and very old, what we could do was simply fly back there a couple of times a year, and so then we come back here, and after they have died, there's very few people who know them. We get very little community support simply because we don't come from here. Our extended family isn't here. Hey, Claire, what do you think? I think it's time for a little music break.
And let's give out that phone number again, so if people do want to call us with any questions or they have any specific questions or issues, they should just give us a call.
At 463-6433. I'm going to repeat it, 463-6433. Call us.
Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly all your life. You were only waiting for this moment to arise. Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these sunken eyes and learn to see all your life. You are only waiting for this moment to be free. Blackbird, fly. Blackbird, fly. Into the line of
a dark black night.
Welcome back to Mind Over Matter. I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder, and with me in the studio tonight is Claire Richardson. She's a board member of the Foundation for End of Life Care and a volunteer chaplain at Bartlett Hospital. And the topic we're focusing on is death, well, dying, death, and bereavement. And I wanted to mention, Claire, about Hospice's bereavement group that's actually going on right now. About twice a year, Hospice sponsors a bereavement group, an 8-week bereavement group that meets once a week for 2 hours in the evening, one night a week. And I lead that group. Now, some people say, well, why have a bereavement group? And I really think this fits into what we were talking about earlier, which is the mobility in American society. Either the person you lost may be unknown to your friends in Juneau because they live far away, or you may have just moved here and nobody knows your deceased husband or your parents. And so because of the high mobility, the disbursement, and the lack of rituals around dying, bereavement groups now are offered in most communities by hospice. What they do is they provide a place to actively do grief work. And as I said earlier, bereavement cannot happen alone. You need people. And for many of us, where else can we openly share our feelings without feeling guilty that we're burdening friends, but you can openly share your feelings with the likelihood that the person in the bereavement group who's just also had a significant loss understands what you're going through. So you, in our groups, and I'll tell you, I've been doing these for, many years. I can't even count them. And they're, I'd say, virtually my most rewarding work because I can feel the benefit to people. They know that whatever they say will not go outside the group because we sign a pledge of confidentiality. One of the other things that I really think is important about having hospice in Juneau or anywhere in general is it provides a real welcoming alternative, a real welcome alternative to that of ending one's life in a hospital. Hospice promotes a philosophy that accepts death as a natural part of living. And I'd like to quote from their website. Hospice is a comprehensive program of care that treats and comforts terminally ill individuals and their families at home or in a home-like setting. Hospice offers pain management, symptom control, in other words, the palliative care we're talking about. Hospice provides compassionate care that can help patients live every moment without fear of dying alone or in pain. And what hospice believes is they have an understanding that a person is more than his or her illness. Hospice believes that psychological and spiritual pain are as significant as physical pain. And that's, I think, we're going in the right direction. I think what happened, there have been many, many books and articles written about the American way of death, really noting that we have lost the support systems to help people grieve. No longer does a widow wear black. Rarely do you see a black wreath on a door. Actually, in the current bereavement group, folks have talked about having a sense that where they work, people are waiting for them to get on with it and get back to work. And although Elizabeth Kubler-Ross made an enormous contribution by really opening up the topic of death and dying, I mean, she was the pioneer, it's somewhat been misconstrued. First of all, people think there are stages of grieving. And what Kubler-Ross, as you know, did, it was stages of grieving your own death. Then we know that there aren't lockstep stages. What she did as a pioneer is really take a look at some of the emotions, anger, denial, grief, all the emotions that people go through. And what's wonderful about the hospice group, by the bereavement group, is that really people see that they're not crazy, that you may have magical thinking, as one book was entitled, about the loss of the author's husband, but you're not going crazy. And it is really wonderful to hear some of the chuckles that occur in the bereavement group when people say, well, you know, I haven't washed my husband's pillowcase, you know, and he died 6 months ago. And we talk about such things as what language to use. Because some people are very sensitive to the word death, and that has a lot to do with our culture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's we use euphemisms, passing away, that's now been transposed into passing.
Mm-hmm.
And we talk about that, honoring everybody's own level of sensitivity. But I think that the language difficulty is all part and parcel of our move away from, well, actually, if you think about it, long ago, death was right in your face. Young people died. See, we always think that it's just old people are going to die.
I would disagree with that with being in Alaska. I mean, I think maybe that resonates in Wisconsin or Chicago, but like I said earlier,
no.
I think so many people here are dying young that I don't think we think it's just about old people. In fact, I'm a little distressed that it's so many young people. And I think in this, somebody said at a dinner party that night, oh, some people, all they do is talk about death. Well, you know, it's a big part of our livelihood here in Alaska, our culture. People are dying at a tremendous rate, and it's everywhere. And it's not just old people.
You're right. And doesn't Alaska have the highest adolescent suicide rate?
We have some of the highest of everything when it comes to types of death, and I think that that's what I'm concerned about as a community or as a state, is how do we hold people together when they're grieving continuously? There's always somebody you know. It's a small town. It's a small state. And when people die, everybody knows about it. And when they're tragic deaths, they're not what we would call good deaths, in the sense of have lived a long life. Then it becomes a despairing. It can actually continue that sadness. So how we help people learn how to grieve, you know, frankly, I've never had to go through a traumatic death before. I've lost my father, and he died what I thought was a young age, but really that's it. And
mm-hmm.
So I think that people also have to realize is your chaplain, your bereavement counselor, your whoever it is, they may be very helpful for you, but it's your journey, and you are the one that's going through it. And for me to suppose that I could even imagine what certain people feel like after losing their loved one would be incredibly presumptuous on my part. And so really the posture, I think, is of, I will listen.
Mm-hmm.
I cannot bring your husband back. I cannot bring your daughter back, but I will listen. I will walk with you. I will be there. I will make you dinner. I will rub your feet. But I cannot bring back the one person you want brought back.
Mm-hmm.
And oddly enough, today, when I came home, there was a letter in the mail, a real honest-to-God letter, Elaine, actually written, not typed, and it was from Ellen Campbell, who many of you know lived here for many years with her wonderful husband, Charles Campbell, and he died quite a few months ago. But today, she's in her 90s, Ellen sent a handwritten note, and what I want to stress to people, if you don't know what to do, a simple card expressing your remembrance and love for or caring for the person that died means so much to somebody. And Ellen Campbell, this was obviously written in her spidery little crawl. And, you know, if anyone knows Ellen Campbell, she does not communicate very well. I mean, Charles was the communicator in the family. But I just want to read this one sentence from this 90-some-year-old woman who said, "Dear loved friends, your generous outpouring of love and sympathy were so beautifully expressed about Chaz going on to heaven. Thank you for the soul food they've been for this shaky 91-year-old lady."
Oh.
So for me, I feel like I thought, oh, soul food, you know, by literally making food for people, writing these small notes, it's not earth-shattering, but every little bit counts. And my mother kept every card that was written to her after my father died. And once a year, she brings them out and reads them. It means a lot to an 85-year-old living alone.
Absolutely.
And for this shaky 91-year-old lady, she calls it soul food. And I think that's what we're talking about. How do you nourish a broken heart?
One of the things that folks, participants in my bereavement group have brought up is the discomfort when they're walking. Let's say they're in the supermarket or they're walking down the street and they spot an acquaintance who surely knows that, let's say, their husband has died, and they can see the acquaintance shift their eyes and avoid them. I think what's going on is just what you're talking about. What do you do if you run into somebody who you haven't seen in some time, but you know that they have recently been widowed? What do you do?
Hey, you know, Foodland, Fred Meyer's, they're great places to have a good cry. I have been in both of those stores before, and I've run into people who have had loved ones die. And all I, you know, sometimes they just want a hug.
Yeah.
And sometimes they cry. And you know what? It's okay, folks. Like, this is not a shame-filled thing. You are in sorrow, and people should be able to respond to that. What we're afraid of is it makes us think of losing our own spouse or our child or our own sibling. And so that pain is sometimes really hard for people to relate to. And I just encourage you to say, "Hello, I remember Charles. I remember this. I remember that." People want to hear about their child. They want to hear about their loved one.
And if you don't have the words, simply, this is what I've learned from the bereaved in my group, just to have it acknowledged with a hug, "I've been thinking of you," mm-hmm. just an acknowledgement. You don't have to be eloquent. You don't even have to say much. It goes a long way. What doesn't work is avoidance.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's, like you're saying, we're projecting our fear, our own fear of dying, our own fear of being widowed. Both my parents died in their early 60s. My dad died 9 months before my mom. He had had a stroke. And before my mom died of breast cancer, she talked to me very gently about how interesting it was, she said. The friends she didn't see after Frank died
mm-hmm.
and the people who came out of the woodwork.
Mm-hmm.
And she was very understanding. She said, "We're the first, Frank was the first in our group of friends to die. And I think it really scares everybody."
Mm-hmm.
And that was back 30 years ago. So people didn't know what to do with a single woman.
Well, that's
socially.
The dynamic. That's in that particular age group. But I think hopefully with the younger generations, back in the day, you had to be husband, wife. I think for most of us, we're past that. But for our parents' age, that was still very much the dynamic, that it would somehow not be balanced. And so, and I'm just like, let's get over it. Let's just move on. Come on. Really,
and,
folks.
And actually, it's the accompaniment. It's the companionship that right. I think makes all the difference, especially for, well, for anybody, but especially for somebody who's widowed. You know, they're probably, maybe their best friend just died, the person they do most of things with. And so certainly dinner invitations and walks and companionship mm-hmm. would be much appreciated.
And what somebody suggested to me was, it's really great right around the funeral. Lots of people are there. There's lots of energy. But, you know, a month, 2, 3 months down the road, everyone's moved on with their life, and you're still grieving. And so that's a great time for people to reach out. So today, if you can think of somebody whose spouse or somebody died a few months ago, this is the time to maybe write them. You can say, oh, I didn't write them yet.
Yeah, never too late. Claire, you also are a volunteer chaplain at Bartlett Regional Hospital. I have used the hospital services, let's say, many times over the last 30 years, and I've never run into a chaplain, so I think there's other people like that, too. Tell me what you do.
Well, first of all, I want to let you in on a big old secret. In the newly remodeled Bartlett Hospital, there is an awesome room, the spiritual prayer room, and it is right down the hall from the gift shop. And I encourage anyone, staff, patients, people who are visiting, it's a lovely, quiet room where if you need just a quiet place to go in, you don't want to go to the cafeteria, and you want to maybe speak to your loved one or somebody, or you just want to be alone, it's a lovely room. It's open during regular, you know, hours, and it is available for you. And I encourage people to take advantage of that room at the hospital. It's a nice, quiet place. There's a Mark Kelly photo that's up on the wall, big giant framed, and it's just very restful. So I encourage people to use that room. It's got a box of Kleenex in it all the time. The chaplains have been, the volunteer chaplain corps there has been there for many, many years. It is comprised of so many people who are of different denominations, and they give of their time. Some of them are ordained like priests or nuns, but there are many pastors from different churches from all over town, as well as volunteers. And
lay people.
Yes, and some of them have more training than others, but all of them are given modeling. They get to follow another older chaplain on rounds to learn how to do it, and we have quarterly trainings, as well as we have to do all the safety tests and everything that mm-hmm. employees do. But what's great about it is each chaplain, when they take a rotation, they're available 24/7. And so I've been called in at 2 in the morning, 6 in the morning, 10 o'clock at night. But we go in every day. We also serve rainforest recovery, the mental health unit, critical care, med surge, and OB, and sometimes the ER. And if you would like a chaplain to come hang out with you at transfusion at the cancer therapy, we can be there as well. But that's by invitation if they want us to be there.
Can a patient ask to have a chaplain present?
Absolutely. A patient can ask. A staff person can ask. And you can also say you don't want to see a chaplain. And
okay.
I'll never forget one of my rounds, you know, the patient had stipulated no chaplain visit. But I knew the person, so I thought, okay, I'll just do my game face. I'll just be Claire Richardson, you know, just stick my head in. And he was like, oh, well, come on in. I said, well, you know, you didn't want to see a chaplain. I'm a chaplain. He goes, you are? You? Oh, my gosh, come on in. So I guess maybe I'm the chaplain for the
people who don't want chaplain.
Exactly.
Well, what happens if, let's say, you're of no religion, you're an atheist, and
you're my favorite.
Okay. So what does a Christian chaplain do?
You know, I think it's not necessarily whether it's a Christian chaplain or a Jewish chaplain or a Buddhist chaplain. It's a human being who's there to be with you on the journey. Mm-hmm. And I have met all sorts of patients from close to death to dying, you know, to dying right there, to babies being born, and mothers going through some problems and in ER with some trauma situations. And we are just there to be part of the journey. And for some people, that means they want to just talk. And they have questions. And when I was in England on my internship, this one patient who was dying, he said to me, well, do you believe in God? And I said, well, what do you believe? And again, I think he wanted to talk about what he believed,
yes.
not what I believed. And so part of the training is really we're there to listen and to be of service. And that can be for anybody.
Wonderful. I have a question before we wind up tonight. We have some time. With the foundation of end-of-life care, Are you addressing a problem that has come up because of the great advances in medical technology, and that is the medicalization of dying, heroic interventions, more high-tech methods for prolonging life, but not necessarily improving the quality of life? And I know a lot of my friends are very careful to write a legal document saying, I do not want this intervention, I don't want that intervention. And they're even very nervous about how to frame that document in case of dementia, because when they're not able to make those requests themselves. So in a recent Boston Globe survey, only 17% of patients in Massachusetts report, 17% of patients, so they were obviously interviewing only people in medical care at the time, report discussing end-of-life care issues with their physicians. Most of the respondents wanted to die at home, surrounded by family and friends. Unfortunately, statistically, the majority of people die in the hospital where they don't want to be.
And it's very expensive.
It's very expensive. It can ruin families. Mm-hmm. It's horrible ethical issues that come up. When Obama so wisely and correctly wanted to include in the Affordable Care Act provisions for counseling around end-of-life issues, and that was shot down by the ignorant who bought the propaganda that it was death panels, and of course it had nothing to do with that. We can see the fear around the issues, and we've got new ethical dilemmas for physicians coming up. Either I'd like to know if the Foundation for End-of-Life Care is looking at that, is educating, you know, physicians and residents. What do you know about that?
Well, we're always open to working with Juno Medical Society. They help support the Lonnie Leary coming and the workshops. We had 5 physicians, quite a few nurses, social workers come to that. I have a dream. I have a dream that in the next 10 years, Alaska is going to have the kind of culture and environment where the information is readily available, that people feel comfortable talking about it. And part of Foundation for End of Life Care is sharing information. There's not even a website that links all the hospices and all the palliative care options in Alaska. It doesn't exist. And also with the expense of traveling, being able to train hospice workers and volunteers throughout the state in a cost-effective way, these are things that we're looking at. I do think, though, that for most people in the time we have left, I can say that you're not alone, but you do have to reach out if you have problems with grieving, if you you don't know how to help somebody who is grieving. There are resources here in Juneau, and Hospice and Home Care of Juneau is a fabulous resource. And like Elaine said, you have that bereavement group. There's so many things that are going on.
We have social workers who provide counseling for people who are dying and who are bereaved.
Right. And there's a resource library at Hospice. And for families that are grieving, we have all age-appropriate information, which is so important because you're working with young children and then teens, and it can be daunting. But I do think that education is really important. But also, here's just some basic tips. I found at the hospital, at the hospice in England, Cecily Saunders used to make sure that Monday was no visitation for patients.
Let's mention who Cecily Saunders is.
She's like
Dame Cecily Saunders is
the British Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. Mm-hmm. There were 3 women in Canada, the U.S., and England who started hospices back in the 60s, and Cecily's was the first. And but she would have Mondays was no visitation. Why? Because the patients were exhausted after a weekend of having family and relatives and friends come visit. So I would just caution you, if you're visiting someone who is under hospice care or in the hospital, it's great that you come. Make your visit pretty brief. This is no time to start camping out unless you're family, and that's different. But when you're coming by to visit, make your visit short. Wash your hands before and after. We have, hand sanitizer outside the doors. It's a really exhausting for some patients. They want to put on their best face. They want to be up for you. So make your visit as sweet and short as possible. And if they're asleep, don't wake them up. Just have a little note that you can write a little note and say, this is Betty. I came by to see you. I'm thinking of you. Just little things like that mean so much. But if they're resting, they're resting for a reason. And I would just like to say to all those that are out there grieving, listening to the show, you're grieving for a loved one, be gentle with yourself. Don't give yourself a time frame. If somebody tells you to get over it or that you should be moving on, you are where you're at, and you have just had a tremendous loss in your life. And yes, you're going to put one foot in front of the other, but some days it's not going to feel like that's possible. And I would be the last person to tell you to buck up and move on. If you need to be there, you need to be there. But support is available, and we can walk with you on that journey, but only you can take those steps. And we can be next to you, but we cannot tell you how fast to go.
And grieving is a hard job. It is called grief work for a reason. And I know that if you've just lost a significant person in your life and you're working a full-time job, you're going to be exhausted. And if you aren't working a full-time job and you've just retired and you're suddenly widowed, you're going to be lost. You're going to be exhausted and lost. And all those feelings are part of the grieving journey. There's a difference between grief and depression, and grieving is work. I see you have a little booklet, Claire.
I've got lots of books here that I'm going to leave with you, Elaine, as a resource for your bereavement group. But this is by John Garvey. It's called Death and the Rest of Our Life, and it is a book on grieving. And I would just like to read a very couple lines from Yeats, and this was written in 1919. It's almost 100 years ago. But is there any comfort to be found? Man is in love, and love's what vanishes. What more is there to say?
And that is so very true. Just a couple of thoughts before we wind up, Claire. Do you think that your experience in London at the first hospice, the world's first hospice, can inform us in Juno or in about how to do it a little bit better? What would you say they know how to do?
Well, I think one thing that they realized is that it's a collaborative effort, that the doctors, the nurses, the psychologists, the therapists, the chaplain, they all have an interconnected role to play in working with the patient and the family. And I really like that holistic integrated approach. And a lot of times in our medical care profession, the spiritual side is negated because many of the medical care professionals do not see a role for that. And so I would actually like to see that, but it's difficult with volunteers, whereas in like Harborview Medical Center, which many of us have used, or Swedish, it's actually infused and part of the professional staff. So that's just my little feeling, is that we're a hub for Southeast Alaska, and I'd like to see a more professional approach to integrating all facets of a patient, their psychological profile, as well as their emotional state, their spiritual state, and, of course, the physical. And I would like to see more education. That's why I'm on this board. I want to reach out to people and have all sorts of different workshops. People are hungry for this information. They want to know what to do. And they need sometimes a structure or container to be able to proceed.
And sometimes it's hard to proceed. You have that wonderful book at home. One has that wonderful book at home that the Foundation of End of Life Care provides.
When you're not here, available at Hearthside.
And you may also have the form for medical directives, and yet it sits and sits and sits on your table.
Oh, yeah.
So I have a suggestion for the kind of workshops. Have workshops. We were talking about to fill out the book, but also the medical directives,
mm-hmm.
and just so people can have a group where they can sit down and do it.
Okay.
So I'd like to thank our audience so much for tuning in today, this evening, to K2. I'll be hosting another program, Mind Over Matter, Monday, May 6th at 7 p.m., with another guest, namely Mark Wheeler of Big Brothers Big Sisters. Mark and I will be discussing how at-risk young people and kids suffering from depression or other psychological problems really benefit from having a mentor. So thank you, Claire Richardson.
Thanks, Elaine.
For your wise contributions this evening. And thanks to our technical support, John and Dolly Kramers, who are missing an hour of the Folk Festival tonight so they can multitask throughout this show. So see you on May 6th at 7 p.m.
Good night, Juno.
Good night, folks.